So this is the title of my talk. It will kind of try to review the situation as we understand it in terms of string formation in gauge theories, with main emphasis on QCD. This is a much reverted version of the talk I gave here last fall at the QCD string workshop. Only the showmanship stayed in the talk. The rest is quite different. So I listed my collaborators who worked with me on this topic over the years, and it's a nice topic because it gives you an opportunity to think about modern things, strings and domain walls and all that. So I will mainly talk about recent work in QCD and the Z2 gauge model. I will discuss the Dirichlet string, the closed binding string, and the Casimir energy in the ground state in both cases, and talk a little bit about string duality and how much or how little we understand about string formation in gauge theories. So first I just want to have a brief introduction to what we mean by string formation in field theory, and whether it exists at all, because we talk about it, but are we seeing that string? Then the Dirichlet in 4 and 3 dimensions in various gauge groups, then the Dirichlet Casimir energy, then the closed string spectrum, and there are brand new results, or relatively new results here, which we have not shown before. I'm not going to talk about the high-spin global spectrum, which is a very interesting, provocative piece of work, the Casimir scaling of the flux, or the troughed flux quantization. And I'm also not going to discuss low-precision stuff from various authors, because they just confuse the whole picture. So I'm only going to talk about high-precision spectra and their interpretation. I'm also not going to talk about very nice, more theoretically oriented stuff like ADS, CFT type connections and their implications. And Rich is an expert on that, and he gave us several talks before. So there is a quark and an anti-quark, and there is a confining stuff there. We don't know what it is. Do you recognize your favorite vacuum here? So what is this confining fuzz connecting the two? Is it a string? Can we describe it in terms of a collective string coordinate? And the best way to decide that is to look at the spectrum and to see whether the spectrum is string-like or not. Now, the connection with microscopic string theory, of course, remains unclear. But if we provide the spectrum, and from it we deduce an effective string Lagrangian, that is certainly the string Lagrangian which should emerge eventually from a string description if it exists for QCD. Well, the string is? Yeah, well, I think that very much will depend. Yes, that's a good question. That very much depends on the representation of this theory, as I will argue in a minute. If you take the simplest gauge model, it is Z2 in 3 dimensions. Now that has an underlying microscopic string theory in terms of loop equations, if you can call it a string theory. That's Poyakov way back, talking about 25-year-old stuff. So it's a beautiful reformulation of what you would call the Z2 or the equivalent Ising model, but of course nobody can solve the loop equations even after 25 years. Now, that string theory really is equivalent to fermionic, microscopic fermionic loops. So the whole recasting of the theory was in terms of microscopic fermionic loops. But at the same time, when you look at the development of the string in the semi-classical expansion of the domain wall, which you can create in this theory, it is a bosonic string. It certainly has, in the semi-classical dual representation, a finite classical width and then fluctuations around it in terms of string collective coordinates. Yeah, David. Very likely. In fact, this is what I will call, you know, the massive or breathing excitations of that object at finite end, and how we really deal or cope with the connection between the collective string coordinate, which is supposed to describe the spectrum, and the width of the string and the rest, will come to a limited extent from what I am going to show you. But you are.
The area of perceived guidance, which the case we have there, the question of whether it's infinitely thin is also the question of what dimensional space the string probably
is. This is a lovely.
And so that, you know, that's not an easy question to answer until you know what degrees of freedom you have to put on the surface. And so
this is a perfect topic for a discussion session. But, you know, in the talk, let's just stick with the what we have, which is the spectrum and its interpretation in terms of a collective string coordinate and its Lagrangian and Hamiltonian. So first I want to show you that, yes, there is a string. So I'm going to show you, for obvious limitations, a pretty good picture in three dimension D equals 3, Z2 gauge group, where I will show you that you have both massive and massless excitations. At short distances, it is not a string in some visual sense. At large distances, it is. And then the question is how well the collective coordinates describe the asymptotic behavior. So what we have here is a quark and an antiquark very close to each other. Separation less than 0.1 Fermi. Scale is set at hog by the string tension of that model. And then what we have here is something which we can run in real time. Why? Because we can determine the low-lying spectrum. So we have the exact wave functions from the correlation function. You can take a superposition and you just run it. So actually you can produce real-time simulation of the string. The limitation in QCD is the relative low accuracy of the wave function and the data, but even there it could be done. But I'm showing it for the showmanship in the Z2 in three dimension. So that is an object which eventually will evolve adiabatically into a massless string. But let's look at it at short scales first. So this is the guy. And that's what it does in real time. Now, note that what happens is a dipole-like object. So therefore, it is flip-flopping between a minimum and a maximum in the distribution, wave function distribution. But it is basically a dipole, which is just vibrating between the quark and the antiquark. Now, you stretch it out to 6 Fermi. That's the object you get in a static fashion. And that's what it does in real time. So this looks like a string. Now, we go back to 0.08 Fermi, and we pick another state which is higher than the one I showed you before. It's again bag-like, but I will show you that this will evolve into a massive string-like excitations. So this is the breathing mode which you expect if in the semi-classical expansion the string has a finite thickness. So this is the object again, and you can see that it is pulsating. And it adiabatically evolves into this object, which is the massive excitation of the string. So from it we learn, yes?
What are we actually looking at?
What we are looking at is the wave function density, if you will, of the, so the. Yes, but what you have is that you have the semi-classical solution. Then you have wave functions, which are the excitations in it, and then you can pick, an initial state which you run in time, and you can look at the density distribution related to it. The energy density would look quite similar too. So you can plot various quantities. It doesn't really matter what you plot. It is almost, kind of a universal behavior what you are seeing here. The simulation is not in real time. The simulation determines the spectrum, and from the spectrum you can run this stuff in real time. So the questions we want to understand is, do we have massless Goldstone modes? What is the local derivative expansion of the Goldstone modes from the fine structure in the spectrum, preferably? Then do we have massive excitations? You just saw one in the Z2. Then how do the breathing modes will affect the effective Lagrangian? And then we would like to know the details of the string properties. Is it bosonic? Yes, it will be bosonic. Is it Nambu-Goto? Cannot quite be Nambu-Goto, we all know. Does it have rigidity, which is a very important issue for the QCD string? Those are just a sample of questions you would like to find out. So before I get into this thing, let me try to describe the generic features of a Wilson surface we expect in a lattice gauge theory. There will be nothing revolutionary here in what I will describe, but it is useful to think about the Wilson surface this way. At least I find it useful. So I do it for illustration on the Z2 gauge model, but it could be done also the same way in a QCD. So in the Z2 gauge model, we have a Z2 easing duality. So that makes the model very easy to tackle, or relatively easy to tackle. In the easing representation, it has a bulk phase transition point, which is second order. But the Wilson surface in the Z2 representation actually have a roughening transition at point 4. And the Wilson surface at strong gauge coupling has a mass gap. It will lose the mass at the roughening transition, and there's a gapless surface here. So therefore, if you live in the Wilson surface, you will see that roughening transition, which we know is Kösterlitz tauless, and in terms of the description of the Wilson surface, it is related, very much related to the role of screw dislocations in the Wilson surface, because as you know, the XY model maps into solid-on-solid type models. The solid-on-solid models have the screw dislocations in it. And just like in the XY model, the phase transition is the liberation of the vortex pairs. Here, if you will, it is the liberation of the screw dislocation pairs. So it's a nice description. Now, the surface will lose its mass here, and it remains gapless as you approach the continuum limit. Now, the interesting question which arises is that what kind of crossover do we have here in terms of universality? We know the universality of the massless surface here. It is just the Gaussian model, massless Gaussian model, which you can describe in terms of conformal field theory. Of course, when you are staying close to the roughening, the lattice version of the effective Wilson surface Lagrangian will have additional operators, like the Sine-Gordon operator will be present. They are irrelevant operators as far as the Gaussian fixed point is concerned, and we have a pretty good understanding what happens here. But for example, that thing obviously doesn't know anything about bending or rigidity. So the question is, as we go over to the bulk continuum limit, what happens on the surface? Because when we land here, we have the string which we want. So there's an interesting kind of crossover behavior here whose details are not very well understood. We don't expect a phase transition again in the surface, but it is not excluded. And I will spend most of my time in this region, although we have a ton of results also here. Yes? Here? Target space, Lorentz invariance. all we can do is that we take the spectrum here and check whether it agrees with the Lorentz invariant expectations of, say, a string soliton which is winding along one particular direction. So restoration of Lorentz invariance will be an interesting and important issue. Yes, so what we will have is that we never really will have a target space. What we will have is Goldstone excitations of the field, and we will talk about their effective Lagrangian and ask the question how close this effective Lagrangian of the Goldstone field will mimic an expected string-like behavior. Now, those effective Goldstone Lagrangians have very similar features to the chiral Lagrangians, that they will have in it operators which correspond to the Lorentz invariant leading terms, and there will be lattice corrections to those, and this is where the violation of the Lorentz invariance is hiding. So then we look at those operators and ask the question, how well can we see that the wrong stuff is going away and the relevant operators are staying and dominating? And then, of course, we will see or ask how this is related to the collective string coordinate and the Lagrangian you write down in terms of it. So I would say that this is very well understood and controlled, but the technical details, how far you can push it, is interesting and not. Well, I don't know what you mean by it. I would say yes, it would be equivalent in the sense that if you create a domain wall in the phi 4 in the continuum limit, it would have a worksheet description, this domain wall and its fluctuations, and we expect it to be very similar to what Weber string theory will appear here, which is... Yeah. In the next couple of slides, I will show you what kind of Lagrangians we hope to see and their behavior in terms of those relevant and irrelevant operators. Yes. Well, the interacting. Well, okay. So let's back up. I mean, there are two issues here. One is whether there is a reasonable start for a string, if you will, the quantum mechanical string, which you want to use for the description, and even the nature of that one is unclear. Now, once you start adding loop corrections to it, what kind of spectrum will emerge? We have a few examples. If you take the Nambu-Goto model and you look at it in the critical dimension, now, in our chiral perturbation theory language, you have a leading term and loop corrections to it. Now, is it an interacting string or not? Of course, we can solve the Nambu-Goto exactly, and the exact spectrum exhibits an interesting and probably wrong spectrum. But you would call it a non-interacting string.
In this particular
yes. Yes. That all depends on. Yes. That all depends in Z2 how well you can expand it semi-classically. And in fact, there is zero evidence that complications would emerge. You know, the semi-classical expansion of that interface works incredibly well. Well, it's a big gap or not, that's the opposite statement, right? Okay, so what do we expect? When you create the Wilson surface in Z2 and the equivalent phi 4, you will have in the spectrum a massive scalar which lives in the bulk, but it is coupled to the Goldstone modes which live in the surface. And there will be effective calculable interactions between the Goldstone modes and the massive scalar, which lives in the bulk. And then you will have Feynman diagrams, whose couplings are derivative to the Goldstone mode Xi, which is actually a coordinate which lives in the target space. So Xi has d minus two components in this description. So that is the first sign that you may get something string-like. That is your Goldstone mode. Now, that kind of Feynman diagrams in the limit when the momentum transfer is much smaller than M, the mass gap in the bulk, then hopefully can be contracted and described by an effective term, which is your first non-trivial interaction term of the Goldstone modes. So this is how an effective Goldstone-like theory in this limit should emerge in the calculation as you approach bulk critical point. So on that slide, you see, I think, lots of the features Herbert was asking, because you see the interplay between the Goldstone mode and the massive scalar. You see the underlying field theory that is all in the semi-classical expansion. And then you ask, are the Goldstone modes approximated well enough with this kind of effective terms in this limit? This is the gap in the bulk. Well, what that means is that obviously that string limit is expected that the inverse gap, when the string is much longer than the inverse gap, so you will have a hard time to see the string formation when you go to the bulk continuum point, because your A scale is shrinking. So if you, we will establish in physical units that you need about 3-4 Fermi to develop the string. And of course, when you are close to the bulk, that can imply an enormously long lattice. That's all. But you still have a gap. There's nothing funny here in terms of that gap going to zero. You just have to work at smaller lattice spacing and bigger lattices and longer strings in lattice units. Well, I'm pretty sure that there are all sorts of interesting issues here. We will try out the simplest. We will compare and then worry about possibly important corrections or complications later on. I know exactly what you mean, but I'm not sure I completely see it the same way, but we can talk about this later. No. So we have lots of terms, of course, and that depends on the dimension. It turns out that from open closed string duality, that's not an independent term in D equals 3, but it would be an independent term constrained in D equals 4, and then there will be higher operators too. So we have, and in addition, I don't know why, but Lüscher from string theory motivations insisted that people should add a boundary term, which he originally did, and that boundary term he thought he needed, but then he realized that open closed string duality will set B to 0. So we have the leading term, the Goldstone, those terms and higher dimensional operators in the limit when the string is long enough compared with the inverse mass gap. So let's go on and see the Dirichlet string. First results, which you saw many times before, some of you. When you define the string spectrum for the Dirichlet string between fixed and quarks, you have three good quantum numbers, which will fully characterize the string excitations. Of course, the same quantum numbers can occur several times because you have radial string excitations, if you will, but this is an unambiguous way of selecting the various gluon field excitations surrounding this quark-antiquark axis. Now, you capture the states with fairly complex Wilson line type operators, and point group theory will give you, is enough of those combinations, the various quantum numbers of the gluon field excitations. and you put that into fuzzing, and you huff and puff and fuzz, you will have very large correlation matrices, and from it out comes this thing spectrum. That is the SU3 in four dimension, where what I color coded was the levels which should be degenerate according to, say, a simple asymptotic string description, Goldstone modes with pi over L multiples. And you see that at short distances, it is not at all string-like. I think we understand why. Then around to Fermi, we have a violent crossover of the energy levels into string-like ordering. But the string-like ordering actually doesn't quite agree with the asymptotic Goldstone mode behavior, the pi over L multiples. There is a fine structure remaining. I will talk more about this fine structure later. Here I just wanted to illustrate what kind of spectrum you get. Now the crossover region is terra incognita, that is the worst possible regime theoretically, very difficult to describe. The short distance regime is not so difficult, because I think a multipole operator product expansion kind of reasonably explains it. You have the quark and the antiquark very close. You allow for the color octet excitations of the gluon field surrounding the quark pair. You can write it down in terms of an effective Coulomb-like Hamiltonian, and it predicts a reasonable level ordering, which is followed by what you see there. So I think that's a pretty sensible and good description. The crossover region is absolutely not understood, and then we want to focus on this region. Well, yes and no. Obviously, it's something which we have been thinking about and beginning to try to do. And it would be interesting to see what the large end limit of that figure is. Yeah, no, the short answer is that I don't know what the large end limit of this figure is. We have SU2 and SU3. In four dimension, there is practically no visible difference in structure between SU2 and SU3, but the space dimension is dramatic, of course. So there's a huge difference in the structure between D equals 4 and D equals 3 dimension. So you have at least two parameters to vary.
I mean, you're being cautious, which is correct, but if you think of it as sort of excursion argument, the first threshold that comes in beyond the plane of diagram is
This yellow line is the glue ball threshold.
Right, exactly. So as long as you're
level, not very visible.
At larger distance, so you can expect to be very small. When you come down to the southern region, I'm sorry, the mixing here
is
so wet in my
view. Now, in the Z2 results, life is easier because you have the, easing representation, you can do multi-spin coding, you can use cluster algorithm. For a long time, I spent on multi-spin coding because I thought I could at least compete with Uli. But it turned out at the end that the cluster probably wins in terms of effectiveness by some, not a whole lot. But it does win. Not too surprising, ideal for Goldstone modes, right? That's what the doctor ordered, the cluster algorithm for the large long wavelengths Goldstone mode. So you set up the semi-classical expansion in Z2. That will be the effective Schrödinger potential for the Goldstone excitations in a setting of a very long string-like configuration. And then you are ready to go. You have different quantum numbers which are exact. You classify. This is the kind of wave function I was showing you before in terms of the density plot that Uli asked. This is a very short distance behavior, and that's how the lowest bag-like excitation looks like. That is a string with n equals 8. You can beat this thing to death in Z2. and this is the spectrum. Now, before we get too excited about the spectrum, I have to explain a few things which come in the follow-up slides. This would be the prediction of the Nambu-Goto blindly applied to capital D equals three dimension. This is the data, which scale like beautifully. So there's no little doubt that this spectrum contains much cutoff effects in terms of being close to the bulk fixed point. Of course, that is still not your continuum Euclid and string theory, but the Goldstone modes with fixed ends certainly don't, or the excitations, I should say, don't show cutoff effects. Of course, the lattice spacing is small. Now, the Nambu-Goto you can apply blindly in three or four dimensions. And you know that you should not get the right result. But what many people miss is that the Nambu-Goto is not nearly as bad as people think in a particular non-critical dimension. Because when you look at the quantization of Nambu-Goto, either with fixed ends like a Dirichlet string or a string soliton, then you can check how much you screw the various, Virasoro algebra-like properties. And it turns out, not too surprisingly, that the longer you make the object, the less you violate those things. So asymptotically, you do expect the Nambu-Goto type formula to work. So you can ask the question, to what degree can a Nambu-Goto type formula work? But I find, both from various, analytic calculations and also from the simulations, is that for reasons not fully understood in four dimension and fully understood in three dimension, is that you should expect the leading, that's a null line because I normalized everything to the expected pi over L multiples in the spectrum. So really, in an asymptotic string spectrum, everybody should stay on the null line. So that would be pi over L multiples for the various string excitations, and I subtract from it, normalized to one, the actual data. So the leading Nambu-Goto is this line. The first correction to it is one loop correction, which you can prove exactly in open-closed string duality, that it should be correct. Also, when people like Polchinski and Strominger try to fix the Nambu-Goto string, basically fixing the various mishaps in the Jacobian, how the previous people treated the Jacobian, they came up with a complicated effective string Lagrangian whose first loop correction also agrees with the loop correction from Nambu-Goto. So Nambu-Goto should be okay up to one loop corrections, which I will show you later, somewhere in this region. And below it, it breaks down, and this breakdown can occur for two reasons. One, you have some other effective terms in the Lagrangian playing a role. Or your Lagrangian is not that local yet, or actually there's a third one, that you have some terrible kind of end effect distortions which are not describing very well at short distances. Look at this scale here, which is set at Hawk to 0.45 Fermi. So here we are out to about between 2 and 3 Fermi, where the universal behavior is beginning to set in. We have data way out to 10 Fermi, so I just took that slide to show you how you begin to approach this limit. That is n equals 2, same features. And now here I show you what's really going on in two ways. The dashed line would be the full Nambu-Goto, applied, of course, in the non-critical wrong dimension. The solid line is the one-loop formula which everybody would agree on. And that is the two-loop corrections to Nambu-Goto, and you begin to see Nambu-Goto diverging here. Of course, it will hit a tachyon eventually if you apply it at face value. And the red line is the first three-level calculation in field theory setting, in the 5-4 field theory setting for the same energy levels. They just basically the exact form of the Schrödinger energies in this potential well of the excitations with endpoint distortions. And interestingly, because Z2 is the center group, you might expect that the square red data, which is SU2. Now that's a QCD simulation in 3D, going through the same exercise what I showed you before in 4D, and they almost show a universal behavior. However, this behavior doesn't have this very funny kind of crossover feature which we saw in 4D. But the 3D SU2 QCD almost exactly agrees with the Z2 spectrum. So in some sense, as the first test, you might expect about the role of the center group. How deep that goes, I don't know. But certainly, the qualitative features are the same. And you see that around 2 Fermi, the data is bang on the one loop correction to the null line, which is expected to be quite universal. That shows, again, for the first 4 excitations, the same features. That red line is the one loop Nambu-Goto, or the Polchinski-Strominger's prediction. That black one is just a fit to the data, and the viola line is just the mean field, field theory calculation. And you see that, of course, the higher you go in the excitation, the later you will get to the leading one loop formula, but you do get on, and it seems that the Z2 wants to approach this universal limit. Here I just gave you this formula in terms of the scaled R variable in dimensionless scale, and those are the energy gaps. And that's what we are plotting here. And it gives you an idea about how the energy levels, as you keep pulling, will eventually go on. But note that this is a fairly, you know, extensive calculation. Here we are out to about 6-7 Fermi. We could go further. In Z2, you can do it. But for example, in the SU2 data, it is difficult to go beyond 2 Fermi. So that's all we know about, in a nutshell, about the Dirichlet string. Now, the Dirichlet string has a funny feature that you expect is through the Casimir energy related to it. And that stirred a lot of noise earlier, because Lüscher introduced this new technique they developed a few years ago, where they determined the Casimir term in the regime where you don't expect it to work, because it is less than 1 Fermi. They claimed it was bang on, so it stirred a lot of discussions and debates. So let me just very briefly summarize what we have there. This is what Lüscher observed. High precision, D equals 3, where they set B to 0. In 4D, they set a phenomenological B, which he would retract now. But at the time when they wrote the paper, they used it. And they claim that as you extract the effective conformal charge by this definition, that you measure to high precision the derivative of the force, multiply by R cubed, you go to large R. The dominant term should be the Casimir coefficient of the Casimir term. You might also call it the effective conformal charge. And they claim that below 1 Fermi, or around 1 Fermi, it converged to the right value. So they would argue that you discovered string formation below 1 Fermi. Now, it may very well be that you see something like the Casimir energy, but of course what is confusing it is the fixed end dirt, which is in the whole calculation. And I should say that rather than using the surface term, B, Lüscher and Weil should have realized that the one-loop formula, the one-loop Nambu-Goto, which is the green dashed line, is what you really expect. And in SU3, in 4D, they were very close to it, but they were trying to use a surface term to explain the discrepancy here, which is not at all a discrepancy. It's just the one-loop correction to the Casimir. Whereas in 3D, where they thought they had a perfect agreement, they should not have had a perfect agreement. They should be on the green dashed line. So it was totally upside down, in my view, their interpretation. The same happens in Z2 when you look for the Casimir. So there is something, an early onset of a Casimir-like term, but here you see in Z2 what is going on. Half of this Casimir energy, so-called Casimir energy, in the Z2 setting is just coming from the deformation of that bag which is stretching and has a classical energy which will contribute to this term. And you can see that the red one is the full what you would calculate to one loop order in field theory, that which is what we did, and the dashed line is coming from the zero point energies, and the difference is really coming from the classical shape of that bag. Of course, if you want to push the argument, you could say that this is not a classical energy because you are in a dual representation, so phi 4 is like your dream kind of superconducting model to describe confinement in the original Z2, but certainly at least in the Z2 5-4 setting, the Casimir energy in this way is actually quite confusing. Now, of course, it's a funny thing because in field theory, you don't have to do anything about the Casimir energy. It is supposed to come out, you know, it is self-regulating. In string theory, of course, you have to regulate, and that is the origin of the tachyon and everything related to your to the tachyon. And of course, string theorists are smarter than summing n from 1 to infinity to get minus pi over 24. But on the lattice, you can see very well that as far as neat isolated string modes are concerned, you get the you get a very rapid convergence to this limit, but I don't think I want to spend too much time on it. That is the lattice version of a Dirichlet field, and you can see very well how you isolate the Casimir term, and the correction terms which are calculable are very rapidly dying out. The funny thing is that now we are summing, say, n from 1 to 3, and we still get minus pi over 24. Now, this is a paradox. The first one was not. And so how to eliminate the end effect is obviously the obvious question. And I have here a quantum mechanical model, which I will leave for a discussion, how I understand why they get this early onset. So something about the closed strings. First, I will show you the Z2 spectrum. Now, in the closed string, so you have a string soliton with unit winding. That is the energy momentum dispersion, where this is the momentum along the string. And that is the Nambu-Gotov formula blindly applied to d equals 3 dimension. And when you take the square root of it and expand in the correction terms to one or higher order, that's how you recover chiral perturbation theory. And so in Nambu-Gotov, this is supposed to be exact. It won't work quite that way, of course. But in the Polchinski-Strominger description, you get additional correction terms in their string Lagrangian to this formula. It's not easy to see how you can get corrections because this is a very nice relativistic formula when the center of mass coordinate of the string is at rest. You can add the center of mass motion, which you can recover. But first, let me show you in Z2 the energy level, the first two. So you have here the one loop Nambu-Gotov. The data will actually break away from it above one Fermi. And that structure will either tell you why the local effective Lagrangian is not a very good approximation at short distances, which is likely, or what kind of other string terms you are picking up. But the red one is the universal one, which is the one loop Nambu-Gotov. That is n equals 2 string soliton excitations, where you have 2 units of momentum running on the string soliton, or 0 momentum running on the string soliton, and that split, the 2 red lines, is predicted from the first universal correction in the formula, and the data seems to be following it. Note that the scale here is again well above 4 Fermi. And of course, there are no end effects because that is a tourelon in our jargon. All the winding is 1. You cannot easily create more than 1 unit of winding. Then SU3, you use again a Torellon operator, you go through the same motion, you can identify the point group energy eigenstates with the excitations of the string soliton, and you can also check the Torellon dispersion when it is moving with non-vanishing momentum, and you see a Casimir-like behavior. That is the Casimir energy for the Torellon, and it is actually here between about 2 and 4 Fermi. So it's not in this very bizarre, very short range where you are seeing the Casimir-like behavior. So that's the first sign that it wants to be string-like. And that's, you know, a very accurate and somewhat difficult calculation. Francesca Moresca did most of the work in Dublin, and it is all written up in her thesis, you know, which came out from our collaboration work. Now, surprisingly, when you look at very short distances and the larger distances, there is again level ordering and crossover. It's different in its nature, but it definitely exists. Here, actually, the blue and the red should be degenerating string theory. At short distances, they are not. At large distances, they are. So there's a level reordering occurring also as a function of distance. The first level looks universal. The second and higher levels have here a funny structure, which I worry about a great deal. They just come out higher than you would expect. That is p equals 0, n equals 2. That is p3, and this is again p3. Now, the string degeneracies are all observed, but the dislocation of the energy levels is quite visible, so there's a fine structure going on there, and the possibility of some simulation lattice-related issues. Do we have, you know, long enough, large enough lattices, small enough lattice spacing, etc., etc.? But you get a structure which, in a way, is very nice in the Torellon case, and on the other hand, has problems which we haven't fully digested yet. So I would say that when you go through the QCD checklist, we definitely have massless Goldstone modes, because I showed you enough evidence that the spectrum very much looks like a chiral Lagrangian for the Goldstone modes with the first leading correction to it. And it is consistent with all the constraints we find in open closed string duality, constraints on the coefficients of that chiral Lagrangian. And the local derivative expansion at large enough separation seem to work, as it should. The issue is that if you go to shorter scales, that description itself is going to break down. So the basic question arises, what do we mean by an effective string theory description at short distances? And this is where presumably all those correction terms become perhaps even more important than in the semi-classical limit, where nobody would expect big corrections. At short distances, if you insist on a string theory behavior, rather than giving up and just switching over back to field theory, that's the regime Rich would want to look at. We definitely see massive excitations. They are breathing modes, and we have not identified yet. You can write down the equivalent breathing mode term in the Lagrangian as the Polyakov rigidity term, if you will. It's very difficult to resolve its role and how precisely you can pick it up from the spectrum. But definitely they are breathing modes, and they should show up and identifiable in the effective Lagrangian. And what is nice about this is that although we are just beginning to see the structure developing and evolving, there's a back and forth between the string theory sinking and the spectrum you can do on the lattice. And I think this is within the reach of the lattice gauge theory community to have more precise results here. Now, I should say that although it is within the reach, it is not going to be very popular in our community. Here I talk to the convert, but you know, when you write a big proposal, you are going to compete with phenomenologically very important monster, you know, programs. And if you want to be very precise and elaborate here, you would need a very substantial amount of computer resources to do this better, but it would be a very tough competition between practical projects and using the lattice as a theoretical tool, which is what I love, but that is not something which sells to the DOE, obviously. I think I will just stop here.
Do you have any strategies to look for rigidity?
Yes, what you should, there are two ways to do that. The first one would be the obvious and very difficult, and I don't know how successful, that you need a very fine spectrum. We have definite predictions what the rigidity term will introduce as a correction term and try to pick it up. But a smarter way would be to find a way to actually bend this damn thing and measure the bending energy. I did that in Z2 analytically, and it works. So for example, you can introduce an external force in Z2 and bend it, and from the bending energy you can defer or determine what the rigidity is, and it agrees very well with other ways of determining it. But we haven't done it in QCD yet. Yeah. We looked at the breathing modes in Z2, and we find them, and they have the expected behavior, namely what you would expect from the semi-classical loop expansion. It's not easy to find them because they are higher lying, and also I didn't. I will get back to you, and I also didn't tell you that there's a very intricate interaction here. Imagine you have, say, a string, a soliton with two waves running back to back, two chiral modes, left and right movers. They can annihilate into a massive excitation on the same string. Of course, they could also annihilate into the bulk. So all those are complications to determine the effective chiral Lagrangian term. In QCD, we just don't have them. That would require very high precision. It's probably doable, or some new smarts, how to bend the QCD string. We haven't done it yet. It's a good question. Yeah. Yes, correct.
If we're slicing the machine where the string is stable, it is exactly counterintuitive. It's fine, exactly the opposite of what
you expect. But if you have a string soliton or a Dirichlet string, it cannot be unstable because of the negative rigidity. But you are correct that the rigidity is negative, and this is why it shows up as massive excitation in the spectrum. If it were Polyakov rigidity with the positive sign, which Polyakov introduced early, that would correspond to ghost excitations, because they appear as higher derivative massive fields, ghost fields, in the effective Lagrangian. But if you have a string soliton, then even if you had the negative rigidity, which I do have in a Z2 case, it cannot destabilize the string soliton.
That's true. Well,
so I don't know what you are.
The point is,
what sense did you mean it?
I mean, for example, if you put an external magnetic field,
yeah, that is a different story.
Type 1, that term goes to zero.
Yeah. I certainly believe that it is. In the Z2 case, the Abelian Higgs might be more complicated. I would love to talk to you more about it, but I don't see any subtlety or big problem here, but I might be missing something. You know, this expansion was straightforward, Rich.
Okay, so let me make one political mark. I certainly hope that we're all lobbying DOE that our agenda is not just getting our results from another, but results from the fundamental.
That's good. That would be this kind of thinking, and I don't get me wrong, I'm not here to tell others who are also doing even more exciting theoretical tool type thing that if we find a way to set aside resources for that, it would be painful, but interesting and useful. But here we are talking about real resources. I mean, to get those results, we were running small clusters, around the clock for more than a year. So we are not talking about small resources here.
I support that agenda, 100%.
Thank you, Rich.
No. Not that it does you a lot of good, right?
Are you on the allocation committee?
Back to physics.
Yes.
The breathing modes are very interesting. And when you put them in the other context.
Yes, ADS, CFT. Yes.
There's no conflict here, in fact, there's a 47, which is a very interesting thing to fully put. There's a paper, which unfortunately I didn't post on the web, which does the following simple calculation. It's now on a yield value. It's not complete, I suppose. If you allow the strength as an infinite string strength to propagate into the extra dimension of ADS 5.
Yes.
Okay. Now, obviously, that gives you extra degrees of freedom. If you integrate those out, you will say, gosh, this string is non-local. Because if you take any local theory and you start integrating out degrees of freedom, and we all know for sure the main Hamiltonian, it will look non-local. So there is a local version of this in ADS 5. A mode that moves in and out of that extra dimension is precisely through the conformal symmetry argument, the breathing mode, because it is identical to move into the extra dimension as to make scale transformation in the first field. Point one. Point two, you can show that in a confining vacuum, those modes that move in and out, instead of being ghostly modes, have exactly the dispersion relation plus the term of order of blue ball mass. So the scale of the green mode is exactly the same scale, and that's 2 pi and so on, of the blue ball themselves. And so you can actually expect, tight calculations, we don't know how to do these back primitive in the sixth dimension, but nonetheless, you get the qualitative properties, and indeed you even have a wave equation which you could try.
Yeah.
Against
this, which here the same thing happens in Z2, the scale factor is square root 3 over 2.
Right. Leave out, of course, the nonlinearities, and therefore you would get, if you put those in, exactly your picture, that there would be coupling between the chiral modes moving down the string, and then see the nonlinearities into those three modes.
It is interesting what you are saying.
But it's not a picture fit.
When I gave my talk here in November at the QCD string meeting, there were lots of string theorists here. I end up giving these kind of talks now more to the string theory guys. And there was a guy there, he's in Michigan, I forgot his name, and he published some stuff, and then he was kicking himself after the talk that he was withholding the massive excitations where his thinking was somewhat similar to what you described. I'm not sure about the details. And he was going home and he wanted to publish it or write it up. Because the string guys beginning to see that in ADS one way or the other, the breathing excitations or the breathing modes. But we should discuss it more. Talk about it more. Yes? Well, we should talk. We have a lot of reasons to talk. Okay, so
okay, fine.
We are done.